address where we were when we left off. It was such a while ago, so I'm going to have to quickly as I can, and you know, that's probably not that quick, but as quickly as I can, just review what we've learned about Machen, kind of his background, so we can get to know what this chapter on doctrine, what he was addressing, okay? Because if we don't know the context, I know I've gotten feedback from a lot of people that get easily lost in this book because there's a context to the book and it goes back hundreds of years, in my opinion. And so I'm going to pass out a couple of sheets here. This is, I printed this from a book written by Hermann Bobbink. If you've never heard of Hermann Bobbink, he was a Dutch Reformed theologian, very popular among the Reformed churches. He would have subscribed to the three forms of unity, which is Heidelberg, Belgic, and the Canon of Dort. Did you want to? I need one here in case Jordan comes back. Okay. And I got another one coming. Holly, would you mind passing this one up? Just so we can get things moving. Thank you. And also, so basically in that sheet that you have there, and I'm going to pass out these sheets progressively, because I want to address a lot of the questions people had, kind of confusion, and we want to get into a little bit of detail here, because to clarify where I'm going with this, and what my conclusions were in studying Machen, studying Presbyterianism, because when we consider Machen in this book, over the summer, we wanted to situate Machen historically, where he was in history, the time, it was, you know, Industrial Revolution, you had the League of Nations being formed, he opposed all these things, so we wanted to establish him politically. We established him as a libertarian, which means he was conservative when it came to government. He didn't like big government, not a fan of tyrants. But at the same time, he was a social liberal. This means he expected the world to be pluralistic. He expected believers and unbelievers to live together in the world. But that's not how we viewed the church. The church is not a pluralistic place, right? It must be founded on the Word and reflected in our confessions and catechisms. So we situated Machen. So we situated him historically, politically, and theologically. He was a Presbyterian. And we see this reflected in the book, even though he's not quoting the confessions, even though he's not deliberately going out of his way to talk about church government, like I did this morning. But he has a chapter on what? The final chapter is the church. In more broader evangelicalism, the church is not that important. But for Machen, it was of utmost importance. As we confessed this morning in chapter 25, section 2, there is no ordinary way of salvation outside the church. Ordinary. We're not saying it's the only way. We're saying the ordinary way people are saved is within the church. Okay, so it was of utmost importance for Machen. And not only that, but doctrine as well. Doctrine as well. And what was happening in the Presbyterian church was you had, like I said before in another lesson, you had three major groups. I wouldn't even call them major. There's really one major group with two outliers, two groups on the side. You had liberals on one side. You had the really conservative Presbyterians on one side who were confessional. They confessed the faith according to our doctrinal standards, and they had a strict view of the Bible. That would include us, right? And then you had in the middle, the, you know, kind of the bigger group. These were the moderates. Okay. The moderates were those who started off conservative, maybe, in their teaching. They may even teach conservatively and preach it. But they wanted to give voice to the liberal in the church and in the academy, in the seminaries. And so they opened up that door, like we can have a dialogue and still ordain people who have some liberal views. They're not really denying the virgin birth, but they're not confessing it, that kind of thing, that kind of mentality. And that eventually led Machen to form the Independent Board of Missions, because they were sending missionaries who couldn't profess that Jesus was born of a virgin. Okay. So there's this mentality that if we compromise on doctrine, we'll have a greater impact in the culture. Think of Princeton, right? Princeton is a big name for American culture. It's always been since they began. And at that time, there was science, evolution was making a big deal in the culture. It's being taught in schools. And it's having an impact. And the problem, I don't know if she's putting up the microphone, sorry. Do you need to hear us? You want to hear us? You can? Are you sure? I can go up there. Okay. Guess I'm that loud, huh? I don't notice it myself. And so there was this move, and I'm going to be repetitive because I have it in my notes. I'm going to say it again, but there was this move to influence the culture was more important than sticking to the doctrine. That's what happened. So in the time of Machen, liberals were not in the majority. They are now, but they weren't back then. The majority were kind of easygoing conservative Christians who wanted to see a Christian society. And the only way they could see a Christian society is if they compromised. And Machen was like, no, forget the society. This society is going to come and go. What we need to do is stick to doctrine. And this is where this leads me. And this shift in practice, they would call it piety, right? Piety versus doctrine, this shift to that, went back in history to what we call pietism. And I handed out a couple of sheets there that you can kind of pinpoint pietism. Pietism goes back to the 16th, 17th, well, I would say more of the 17th century, so 1600s. And you can say that the Puritans had an influence on the early pietists. So a lot of people trace, like Herman Bovink here, he traces pietism to the Puritans, though I would make a big difference between the Puritans and the pietists with that the Puritans always led you back to hearing of the word, partaking of the sacraments, and prayer, right? These were the means that God has given us to heal our burdened conscience if we you know, lack assurance, for instance. We feel as if, you know, we don't see the fruit of the Spirit in our lives. They would always bring us back to the means that God has given us to reassure us, to comfort us, and to cause us to walk in His ways. Versus the pietist was a little different. The pietist would go into dangerous introspection, where you constantly had to examine yourself to prove yourself and never really get to Christ. It's always within, it's always your spiritual experience. I try to define pietism as a piety at the expense of doctrine. Piety at the expense of doctrine. But piety and doctrine for the Reformed go together. We are to have a warm piety. We do have spiritual experiences. I'm not saying we don't. But it must be coupled with and grounded in doctrine. Okay? And so the Pietists began, and the Pietists began, you know, teaching these kinds of things. And I traced it back to a man called Theodorus Frelinghuysen, and he was the major influence on the Great Awakening, the first Great Awakening. Okay. Jonathan Edwards, Whitfield, and the like. And the thing that I'm hoping through the preaching you'll begin to see is that the Bible does not describe a born-again experience. It says you must be born again, yes. Some people cry, some people don't at their conversion. And there's no wooden program or example that we can say that this is how every conversion experience is. None. You can't find it. You would have to overemphasize one person's experience over others. Paul versus Isaac, for instance. Paul had a different experience than Isaac. So the experience itself does not define being born again. And I'll go to Jesus, actually, and what he said in John 3, the famous, you know, born again passage. In verse 8, specifically when he talks about the work of the Spirit, he says this, in converting someone, it says, the wind blows where it wishes, and you hear its sound, but you do not know where it comes from or where it goes. So it is with everyone who is born of the Spirit. So to define and nail down the born-again experience and the steps that it happens would contradict what Jesus said here. He says you don't know how it happens. One day you have life, the next day you do. One day you don't have life, sorry. The next day you don't. You do. Don't do. Okay, getting that down. One day you don't have life, the next day you do. Sometimes you don't even realize it. One day you're believing one thing, the next day you're not, and you're saying Jesus is Lord. There's no process given. Some people there's a process, others there's not. And nothing is really nailed down as law, right? And what the Pietist has done, he has made it law. That's what he has done. And we see this exemplified in the First Great Awakening. I know the First Great Awakening is the golden calf for many Reformed people. And they don't like to hear it critiqued. But there were a lot of problems with it. A lot of problems with it. And we'll get there. Another way we see evidence of someone who was born again is the renewal of the mind. More times than not, we see in the Scripture, someone who was born again is thinking differently. And so he lives differently. And he's bearing fruits of the Spirit. But even that can be very, very small in the beginning. And I always ask, you know, I ask myself, those who put emphasis on a born-again experience, this, you hear of an overwhelming sense of freedom and joy. I always go back to Job. What about Job? Was he not converted that whole time he was in misery? So we must be careful. We have people among us who are probably going through misery who are Christian, who don't feel that joy, that overwhelming sense of joy. And I know this even contradicts with even Pilgrim's Progress with John Bunyan. But John Bunyan was sure to say that not every Christian goes through this process in the Pilgrim's Progress. He's like, this is what I went through. That doesn't mean every Christian is going to go through the same thing. So we must qualify these experiences that we see. And that we hear of from the First Great Awakening. So I came to the conclusion that the First Great Awakening was a proto-liberal movement. They weren't liberal themselves. The leaders weren't liberal themselves. But they opened the doors for it. They were the first to say, hey, doctrine, that's great and all, but don't be dogmatic. It's your personal experience that really matters. Have you sensed this overwhelming conversion experience? That's why in the early American church, You had the Presbyterian and the Congregationalist Church. They were trying to unite. And you had the halfway covenant where they would receive people based on their conversion experience. That's not what the halfway covenant was in itself. But part of their membership interviews, you had to give a credible conversion experience. Not a credible profession of faith. That's how we do it. But they had to give a credible conversion experience. Did you have so much terror of the law? If not, come back another day. Okay? I always relate it to kids. You have different kinds of kids, right? You all have, most of you have had kids. And one kid, you know, they get a prick of conscience, you know, that you give them a look and they're like, oh, okay, yep, I'm going to go this way. I'm going to rethink what I was about to do. And they'll just obey, right? And then you have the kid that you really need to scare for them to do anything, right? I think everyone has one of these. You might be one. And those, you know, those are those who sense that terror of the law, because God had to wake them up to say, listen, you're condemned. You're going to die if you keep going this way. And the other guy, all he needed was a little, oh, okay, yep. I'm going to turn to Jesus. I'll trust in him. Yep, you don't have to tell me twice, right? That kind of thing. So, and that's how I see so-called conversion experiences. They're different. One group to another. And so, I rooted the liberal movement going back to the first Great Awakening, and I will try to, I'm going to hand out reasons why. There's this article here, Why Caution About Jonathan Edwards Is in Order. Jonathan Edwards is probably the most important theologian in America, most popular, probably one of the most educated, and one of the most influential. But like he says here, influence, however, does not necessarily equate with orthodoxy or edification, right? Just because someone is influential and big-named doesn't mean you should follow them in everything. I'm sure there's a lot of great work he has done, but there's caution as well. So I'm going to hand out this one. This I'm not going to go over today. We will... Oh, you want to take it? Thank you. We will cover it when we get to the First Great Awakening in our church history course. And so this next handout I'm going to give is... I'm missing something. Sorry, my child messed up the papers here. So I gotta, oh, here. I blame her. It was my fault, actually. Did you want it? Thank you. And now I'm giving you the handout to what we're talking about here. And just going back to some helpful information, when the First Great Awakening was happening, the Presbyterians isolated the Tenet brothers, and what they were doing, they were really troubling a lot of the ministers. Because one of the major issues with the First Great Awakening was something we were just talking about today. They were usurping church authority. They did not want to rigorously examine ministers and make sure that they were educated and they had seminary degrees. That's why they founded the Log College. Notice college versus seminary. They wanted something easier for the ministers so we can pump out more gospel ministers. It was all pragmatism. They wanted more numbers, so they wanted to pump out gospel preachers. And if you go back in history and actually look at the stats, the Great Awakening did not increase the numbers of church members. It actually declined. Specifically the Presbyterian Church. Maybe you had an increase in other churches, but for the Presbyterian Church, there was a decline. By the 1790s, there were more people, percentage-wise, attending church today than there was back then. For the Presbyterian Church. Now, I don't know all the numbers for every other church. So that would bring us to a percentage of maybe less than 20%. And that's pretty bad. Okay. So, like I said, I believe the First Great Awakening was a proto-liberal movement, and the Presbytery New Brunswick was their presbytery, and like I said, it's the same presbytery that disciplined Machen later on, just like 100 plus years later. So that mentality carried on. Even though we reunited, thank the Lord, between the side that was against the Great Awakening and those who were for it, we reunited, but that mentality remained, I believe, where doctrine doesn't matter that much. What matters is love, or, you know, just preach the gospel. You know, lay people can preach the gospel too. They should be allowed. You know, that kind of mentality. And so when you get to Machen, you have a different kind of fighter, because his fight was a little different than those of the fundamentalists. Machen ended up fighting everybody in the church. So he was a fighter. He fought the liberal. He fought the moderate. And later, after Christianity and Liberalism was written, he fought the fundamentalist. This is the Christian who had a low view of the church, but a high view of societal change. So their purpose, they believe, for the church was to change the laws to make it all Christian. So they try to get rid of alcohol. They try to get rid of theater. They try to get rid of dance, making all these things illegal. This describes kind of the fundamentalists. You still have fundamentalists today. For the most part, broadly, evangelicals are close to lawlessness now than they are to actually caring about the laws. Unless it's a law that suits them, right? It's rather sad. It's like Daryl Hart has said, you know, a lot of people want the blue laws back. They want everything to close on Sunday, right, to observe the Sabbath. But I'll agree to that when I see more of them in church, right? Because most of them are not in church on Sunday. So what's the point of that law if you yourself are contradicting it out of conviction? So anyway, so again, to give background, we're going to jump right into it. And just so you know, on the papers on Pietism and Methodism, I've underlined those things that were important out of the... So you're not reading this and your head is spinning, right? I underlined those things that were important, those things that will summarize what I mean by Pietism. Okay? There were a couple of movements. You had Neo-Nomianism, which believed that faith and obedience was a condition for justification. But the Pietist believed that faith and experience was the condition for justification, rather than just faith alone. Okay. You had to have this experience. And they opposed all scholasticism, that is, any type of study, you know, that comes to a definite doctrine to say, yes, this is where we land. Like this morning, we're Presbyterian because we believe it's biblical. That's after much study and saying, yes, this is where we're going to land. And to say that we believe the other forms are wrong, the Pietists didn't really care for this kind of discussion. It wasn't the knowledge of things, but practice and consistent application that was important. It was the doctrine of living for God, the pursuit of piety, that was more important than doctrine. You see, that's weird, because we believe that too, but the foundation of it is doctrine. That's the foundation of all of our piety. If we don't have the sound doctrine as the foundation, forget the piety. It's not going to flow. And he says here, being born of believing parents, membership in the church, baptism, communion, and orthodox faith, all these things are not enough for the Pietists. They're not enough. Okay? But true faith does not arise except when terror before the law, fear of judgment, and anguish over sin have preceded it. I've met people who are converted, who are genuinely converted, who are complete stoics. I mean, it's like one beat to another. Yeah, I believe. And they live it. And what am I to say to that? Am I to govern the work of the Spirit? No, I can't govern that. All we can do is judge based, as ministers, profession of faith and lifestyle. Right. Trust, they put trust against knowledge, not knowing that trust involves knowledge. You have to have a certain degree of knowledge to trust. The seat is more in the heart, right? The seat of this faith, more in the heart and the will than in the head. So they put the two against each other, heart and head. You know, it's all about the heart, not the head. Forget the head. No, the way to the heart is the head. Some people say it's the stomach. Yeah, but anyway. So that faith as refuge taking, consisting in hungering and thirsting after Christ and his righteousness, is a condition that precedes justification. What's wrong with that? Can anybody tell me what's wrong with putting a condition before someone comes to faith?
Because it's God who saves.
That's right. And if you have a thirst after righteousness and a thirsting after Christ, that's evidence. That's evidence of faith. It doesn't precede it. It's not a condition that you need to meet. Okay? That's the problem with pietism. This is what formed the anxious bench. The anxious bench were for those who felt the terror and they desiring Christ, but they have not yet come to faith. It's like, what? Conviction of sin and the thirsting after righteousness are both evidence that you have faith. If you have a conviction of sin, that you have sinned against God, not just you did something wrong and you're going to face, you know, you're going to go to prison or something, not that, but you have a conviction that you actually sinned against God, that's evidence that you're a Christian. It doesn't precede being a Christian. We must be careful. We need to make those distinctions. And so the law, they describe the law as being for all, but the gospel is only for certain qualified sinners. The guy on the anxious bench that finally comes to quote unquote faith that the minister is happy with, whatever those conditions are, that's when you assure him of his salvation. You don't do it before that. Because, you know, you got to let that terror of the law sink in. You got to let that thirsting for Christ reach a climax. And then finally you can say, okay, my son, you are one of us. You have faith. That is not what we do in the church. Not what we do. That is abuse, borderline. Right? So, there's only a very, to them, to the pietists, there's only a very fine line of distinction between regenerates at their worst and unregenerates at their best. Okay? Again, that's another problem. There's so much similarity between false and true grace. Sometimes you see this in Puritan writings too. But thankfully, hopefully you read to the end and you don't just stay there, because after reading any of them, you'll probably come to the conclusion, I am not saved. I'm not a believer. But for the pietists, believers must therefore always re-examine and test themselves by the marks of a truly spiritual life. The way of salvation is a narrow way by which even the righteous can scarcely be saved. And there are different, the pietist puts people in different groups. The discovered, the persuaded, the concerned, the hungry for salvation, people of little or weak faith, and others. And mind you, all of these are unsaved to them. They're not saved. So the one that hungers for salvation is not saved. I'm like, that contradicts scripture. That contradicts what Jesus was speaking about in the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount was not for the world. The Sermon on the Mount was addressed to his disciples, believers. Okay. So the experience of being sealed and assured only follows after a long period of inner doubt and conflict, and then frequently in an extraordinary manner. Hence why I passed out the sheet on... I'm probably just going to cover this today, just so you know. I'm already running out of time. But I'm not even going to get into the chapter, which is fine. It forms the background. Okay, so this is fine. So I passed out this the sheet on Edwards, and I believe there's an account where his wife, or I don't want to get it wrong because I don't want to misrepresent anything, but somebody levitated from the ground during their conversion experience. I'm like, whoa, that sounds more demonic than it does actual Holy Spirit conversion. You know, so we need to be careful that a lot of things happened that scholars do not talk about because, you know, it may hurt publishing, it may hurt, you know, selling books, but they don't talk about these things regarding the First Great Awakening that we need to be careful of and not follow. Okay? And a lot of it is summarized in what R. Scott Clark wrote in that article back in 2020. And on the second sheet, I'm not sure how many of you have... Lydia, did you get both copies?
I was just looking. I don't think so.
Okay, sorry. I know you came. What page numbers?
566.
Okay, I'll give you this one.
Okay.
And like I said, I underlined the stuff that... You know, I don't want to send people away with their heads spinning. And if you have any questions along the way to clarify anything, please chime in. Yes, Linda.
Well, I got a couple. One of them, you know, I listened a few years ago to Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And I'm wow. But I understand now, in context, it was almost like trying to scare people so they would tremble.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
It's
scare tactics, basically. I mean, am I right? I'm kind of on the right track?
Well, you would have to answer the question, was the gospel in that message? You would have to go back, read it. Did he bring the gospel to bear on the... Or was he just preaching the law? I mean... if you would have to answer that for yourself. Read the sermon again and say, is Christ here? Is he preaching Christ? That's how I would answer that. And from my reading, I didn't read it in detail, so I'm not going to say I know everything there is to know about him and what he wrote, but I didn't see much there.
Well, it's almost like setting the stage for the anxious, whatever you call it.
Yeah.
He's setting the stage for the anxious.
Anxious bench. That would come after Edwards, a little after Edwards. But taking, they got it from him, the idea, kind of the direction that it led to. You have another question?
What about, you know, pray this prayer. You know, you listen to the evangelist and, you know, at the end it's pray this prayer and you'll be saved. How does that fit into what we're, because you still see that.
That comes from the Second Great Awakening.
Okay.
So you got the first, it was a little snowball, right? And as I say, that snowball got bigger once you got close to 100 years later, the Second Great Awakening. That's where that comes from. And it's rooted in Pietism. Both of these movements are rooted in the same movement of Pietism.
And then one more, when you started out talking about... Machen and the Independent Mission Board.
Yeah.
Where does that fit in with the timeline?
Okay.
Was he still in Princeton and he was still
yeah.
and that was a seminary for Presbyterian ministers, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so he was still in that and he formed that because the regular mission board was sending out the wrong kind of doctrine.
Yes. Yep, that was during Princeton.
Okay.
That's what he would be disciplined for. Because you heard the sermon this morning, and we're all Presbyterian, right? We have our form of government, we follow it, but it must be rooted in doctrine. Okay, the problem in that time, Machen saw they weren't, and the Presbyterian Church, so we're not foolproof, right? Our system is not foolproof. All of the OPC can become corrupt if everyone begins to have the same mentality. So there's a chance for that. So I'm not saying the Presbyterian system is going to be perfect. We see it in the scriptures and we have it because we believe that's the system that the Lord laid down for us. But it doesn't mean you're not going to have issues with it. And Machen saw the issues and he started Presbyterian, starting an independent board, right? The word independent is like a curse word for us. being independent apart from Presbyterian, apart from the seminary. But the problem was so pervasive that he had no choice. And it wasn't just him. So there were other men involved. So you can say he was still Presbyterian, just on a smaller scale. There were other men who followed him. Very small amount, but they did. Thankfully, we wouldn't have our church today if we didn't.
Eric,
yes?
In fact, I think it's called the Sinner's Prayer.
Yep.
If someone, would it be wrong to say if someone was so moved during the service to think that they had were experiencing the Holy Spirit calling them, would it be wrong to say you could use this prayer versus you think the Lord would provide them with what to say?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's okay.
I mean, that would be totally different than saying, pray this,
and you'll be saved. Yeah, that's
but
different.
If you were so moved, these words would be appropriate, as opposed to, I don't know, with the Lord. In some cases, I guess the Lord would just instruct them or tell them no. Or even by their thoughts, the Lord would know.
Yep. Or I can say at the end of the sermon, pray with me.
Yes.
Pray as I pray. again, like, what you're trying to avoid is exactly what I would try to avoid, too, is that we don't go pietistic the other direction, too, where, you know, written prayers by someone else cannot be adopted to yourself, right, as your own prayer. I have nothing wrong with written prayers and praying the prayers of others from the ancient church, for instance, who wrote their prayers down, praying it and applying it to yourself if you mean it, right? If you can apply it to yourself, that's fine. See, the kids are already up. But to say, pray this prayer and you'll be saved. No, it's the saved that will pray the prayer. Right. So, good distinction. Thank you, Wayne. Yeah.
What was the reason the numbers declined? Why? You said the numbers declined. This was the Great Awakening. Around the time you're talking about the Ten Brothers. But the numbers declined. You'd expect, this great preaching. Where did those people go?
I'm going to rely on some scholars here. I'm not exhaustive in my knowledge. I don't know everything. But according to Daryl Hart and a few others, there was a shift. The shift went from, I have it here, doctrine, experience, to liberalism. If you want to go through the history of the Presbyterian Church in America, doctrine, experience, liberalism. That's how I form it. And this was during the shift. And during that shift, there was a shift of emphasis on doctrine, right? The church is here for redemptive purposes and means, to experience, which was coupled with activism, social activism. So there was an activist mentality behind many of those who were preaching during the Great Awakening, that if you really want to see, you need to go out and do this, you need to go and do this, you need to get rid of this, get rid of that, and build this kingdom on earth, the kingdom of God on earth. So social activism was
like the temperance movement.
All those, and even back in the 1700s, even though Presbyterians, even sound old side Presbyterians, supported the Revolutionary War, but it's no surprise that the new side also supported it, because they had this shift from doctrine to activism, which is right underneath the experience category, and individualism. Notice, American Christians, no importance for the church. There's no importance for the church. It's me, Jesus, and my Bible. That's all I need. My at-home Bible study, I can study my Bible at home. I can worship at home. We're going through the book, What Happens When We Worship. Beneficial. Because it goes to show in the Bible, there's no such thing as an individual Christian. But the First Great Awakening gave birth to that, the individualistic Christian, that he is really active in society, but cares nothing for the church. The church and the gathering is not that important. Hearing God's word, partaking of the sacraments and prayer, not that important. What's important is individual experience, individual activism, making sure that you're doing your part in society. Those things are good. I tell Christians, you should be involved in society. We're not hermits. We're not monks. We're not the Amish, right? We want to contribute to society in whatever field we've been called to, but not at the expense of the church. That's the primary place we gather for worship, right? We can't do it apart from what God has provided. That is rather unbiblical. We don't see that in the scriptures at all. And so hopefully that answers your question.
Yes.
So the shift. There's a shift from doctrine and being in the church to activism, being individualists. And this is where we get this rank individualism today of Americans. Don't bother me. Don't tell me about God. Just leave me alone. I mind my business. You mind yours. That's the golden rule, even though that's not the golden rule. But that's the golden rule. And, you know, leave me alone. Don't tell me what to do. There's no authority in the church. It's just me and Jesus. Jesus is my head. That's all I need. But in the Bible, he's the head of the house of God, the gathering of the people, not just one individual. So that's important to make that distinction. Well, we've come to the end. Any other questions, comments? I will pick up where I left off. I had a feeling this was going to happen, but that's okay. I think a lot of people needed to refresh and get back into why we're covering this, especially today. Okay. And we'll get into, I don't even know if I'll go over this next sheet because I think I got into a little bit. Pietism leads to kind of a monkish life, right, where we're not involved in society anymore. And there's no more neutral ground between the believer and unbeliever. It's, you know, you got to make everything Christian or you just escape from society. Right? Those are the two options for the pietist. While the Christian has always been involved in society and he places a priority on the ordinary means of grace in the church. Okay? So read that on your own, the second sheet. And next week, I believe, I'm just going to get right into it. I'm just getting right into the chapter. I promise. Okay. Let's, Wayne, would you mind praying?